after all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver. Is it coming
through? Yeah, I can hear you. Hey again, listeners. I'm joined today with Zarif.
Hey, what's up, guys?
And Zareen.
Hello.
We are cousins, not siblings.
We are cousins.
They're not my cousins. Zareen and Zareef are
cousins. Yeah, just in case.
Yeah, not all brown people are related. It's okay.
Yeah, and we will get to that, I'm sure.
God. Yeah. I didn't really have a topic in mind today, but I just figured that the three of us were getting on, and it's like, oh, this is just going to be the brown people episode. But
that's fair.
I don't know. I think like a lot of people are talking about lived experiences right now. And I think, you know, that's something that's better done, you know, face-to-face discussion, or at least like in a dialogue, versus how people will put like an entire 6-tweet thread about their lived experience. And that's why I'm voting for Kamala in 2016. I don't really like
that. Yeah, it's like the difference between Democrats and Republicans I saw was like, the Republicans had a plane that was like heading down like for the ground, and it didn't have anything on the plane. But the Democrat plane, it was also heading down to the ground, but it had like a BLM flag and like a LGBTQ flag on it too. I think that just goes to show the state of our politics today.
I mean, you're probably referencing some political cartoon I haven't seen, but I think it's one of those things where there's a lot of lip service and a lot of just hollow posturing towards identity in not just like politics per se, but like in the broader discourse. And the three of us, you know, working in corporate, right? What kind of hollow gestures have you guys seen so far?
Oh yeah. So let me tell you guys, so they didn't hear the conversation before we started, but pretty much I was just like, okay guys, let me get started. Like, there's so many white people at work. but I mean, pretty much to expand on that, what I meant was, I mean, I do work for, like, you know, a defense contractor. I am not proud of it, but it is my first job out of college, you know. And I am learning a lot, but I am not, you know, condoning, you know, anything that we do, and I'm definitely going to be leaving within the next 10 months, so.
Oh my goodness. No, I feel that, those are, because like I work in automotive supplier, and there are quite a few brown people, because, you know, engineers and stuff, which is nice. But then for us, like, there's so many older white men in power, and I think the only like brown guy who is in an executive level, there's just one who's like top of the top, which is, it's nice that we have one, but I think there's like conforming behaviors that go around at the workplace because everyone's trying to fit in, especially at that level. So they'll say things that are definitely questionable. Like, I've had to have BLM conversations at work when, you know, George Floyd and stuff was going on. Oh, like, there was some good conversations, but like there was also a lot of just trying to explain basic things, but it's a whole different spectrum about what they hear and I guess what we hear.
Yeah, I mean,
How do you expand on that?
I'm not sure, right? Because, you know, I don't want to speak for Zareen's lived experience, but
right.
But it's one of those things where there's the kind of environment I work in is a, it's faceless. And even like when I did go in person, I was the only person on my team, and everyone else was like the kind of person I'd reach on a phone call. And then it'd be like for the scheduled phone call, if you had time to shoot the shit, you shot the shit, and that was about it. So like, politics doesn't really come up in the workplace, except for like guys who are hanging around the water cooler. And you have to butt into the conversations, right? But I think it's one of those things where the demographics of who has this kind of employment and how we define what being middle class is in America, I think that's where it gets put on display. And we kind of like have this tendency to label certain people as, you know, socially reactionary or ignorant, which is correct. But I think really what it just comes to is that everyone's a little bit alienated, and then they show up to work, and there's no context for relation, right? So it's either like
actual genuine, like past the surface relation, right?
Right, right.
Is what you meant. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I agree. It's so difficult. And I think that, like, for example, I work in a place where there's lots of brown people, but it's not like we all interact very often. I work in a totally different department. And like you said, it's so hard to make those in-depth relationships with people. I think something that's been starting to get big in corporate America is like employee resource groups, which is something where it's, for example, women or single mothers or people of a certain race, they will get together and try to support each other that way. Because when you're in a room with a bunch of different people, you don't know different people's views. You don't want to say anything that could, obviously to offend someone, but you don't want to start a fight. So you don't go out and tell your views when you're in a group of people. So it is difficult addressing certain things.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I guess we're jumping straight into the workplace component of this might not have been the best way to have that conversation, right? But I guess the reason why I wanted you guys on is when we talk about how South Asians fit into the whole diversity culture discussion, I think there's a couple interesting avenues on how people get sublimated and expressed. But I think, you know, with our unique blend of lived experiences in this forum, I think what we'll be able to express is how cynical some of this stuff is, how cynically this gets employed sometimes. And I think, like, you know, with what you were saying about employee resource groups, right, is like, it's cool. It's definitely cool, right? But, like, you know, does the support group for women, right, like, does it address, at a systemic level, right? Like, does it deal with workplace harassment? Or if it's a group for mothers, right? Like, does it talk maternity leave? And I feel like it's just like they give you this little, or at least how identity issues tend to get deployed at the corporate level is hey, we gave you a thing, don't complain. At least in my experience,
I like to compare it to, you know, it's kind of like white people's idea of how brown people are, or of how like we should be. You know what I mean? It's kind of like a white liberal. I like to say like a white liberal's wet dream of like what a minority's experience is.
Well, so expound on that. Like, are you trying to get on the model minority hypothesis that people go on about, or are you going more on like how people will have like a ersatz conception of someone's culture and then like use that to base their assumptions? What are you getting at that?
I'm kind of saying like, and like, I feel like when people talk about, you know, especially like Asian Americans talk about identity, it's very, you know, it can get like pretty superficial. Mm-hmm. You know, like they don't really, I feel like, and I used to be this way too. You know, honestly, within the like past, you know, couple years, I would say is, you know, when I started kind of taking the more, you know, colonial, you know, like what happened to our people, like historical sort of, you know, point of view to it. And, you know, that's kind of why, you know, I was interested in hearing, you know, about how you and Zareen kind of like, you know, grew up on you guys, because you guys actually grew up in the homeland for a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Is there, do you want to expound on it first, or would you prefer?
I can.
Like, what was that like for you guys? You know, it's so like amazing to me. It's, like, you guys actually got that blend.
It's so interesting because, like, for most of my life, I was in, you know, that region from when I was 6 to 5 years ago, and I didn't have to think about diversity until I came back in the States. So for me, like being brown and being around all brown people, I didn't really have to think about, like, I knew some things about like racial injustice and that sort of thing, but I never had to think about diversity or diverse issues or ever have to deal with microaggressions or anything like that. It was just, I'm Bengali, everyone around me is Bengali, or I'm brown and people around me are brown. So there was that. And then, but I still did deal with some stuff, because even though I was only away till, like, I came back after I was six, I still had kind of an Americanized accent. So I kind of say this sometimes, like, you're too white for the brown people, you're too brown for the white people. And I kind of experienced that a little bit, where I didn't get bullied or anything, but I definitely had comments made about my level of, you know, speaking in the native language, and, you know, my lack of knowledge in certain things. But it was a great experience. Like, I didn't want to leave. I wanted to do high school there. I had the option to come here, like, junior year of high school. And I was like, no way, I want to stay where I'm at. So it was great, but it was, I think it's different for everyone, the lived experience and everything.
Yeah, right. And especially, it's crazy that you mentioned the language thing, because I feel like for Bengalis, like, that's, like, really important, is, like, the language, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, my brother, he was older, so he struggled with it a bit more than I did, but it was just me having an accent. Like, I could say most things, but my writing level was never on par, because in the time that I was there, in the middle, because my dad was a diplomat, we went to a different place where I wasn't learning Bengali for a little bit. So it's yeah, it's definitely something.
Does that focus on Bengali language, does that come from, like, the pride people have for the literary tradition, or is that just a standard Asian thing of, like, oh, you don't know how to speak it, goddamn? Like, I'm trying to give Bengali people an out on this one.
Yeah, no, I mean, for Bengalis, though, we had a whole war about our language now. So I think that brought in a lot of pride, but I think you're completely right too, Adi, where it's kind of like, they want you to be able to speak the language. If they're like, oh, well, you're from here, but you don't speak the language, that's something that's off-putting, I think, for them, for us. I don't know how to put it, but you know what I mean? I mean, for us, we do have a rich culture in our language, and I love speaking our language, but I think it's just, it's
a beautiful, like, language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, I am really, like, proud to speak it. You know, I'm really proud of what our ancestors, like, did.
Yeah, absolutely. I just, yeah, I don't know. It's like, it's, I feel like every culture, the minute someone's different, it brings about, I don't want to say bullying, because it's not bullying, but it brings about, like, talk. And, like, something I've noticed in our South Asian cultures, there's lots of judging. Not to say there isn't great things about it, but on the other hand of things, you know, like, everything has good and bad. There's a lot of judgment. So I think whatever you do, there's some level of that.
Gotcha.
But how about your experience, Adi?
Okay.
Yeah, Adi, let's hear about yours.
Okay. I mean, I can get into mine, because it kind of will expound on, like, my interest in politics, if that makes sense. And I'll try to be concise.
Yeah, hell yeah.
But this is Adi Origins. It's happening, folks. It's
Adi
happening.
Origins. Let's go.
You heard it here first. I was born here in Michigan to Indian parents. My parents came over around the time of the tech boom in the Clinton era. I was growing up in the Detroit metro area. They just made a personal decision that they wanted to live in India for a while, and they took me and my brother along. And the community that we lived in, particularly the city, but also just, I think of how bizarre India is as a place, right? Is
And can you also tell us, like, what part of India you're in?
My family's from Uttar Pradesh, so we speak Hindi. Yep. But, and that's in North India, but we lived in South India, actually. And where we lived in Chennai, actually, it was surprisingly a little more diverse than I was expecting. I did go to an international school, and most schooling there, if you can afford it tends to be private. So I was kind of in a bit of a background where most people were expats. They were people from out of the country and not Indian who were there either for work or pleasure, but generally people who were being subsidized by their company to live there. And I always had to like defend myself for being American, because a lot of particularly European folks especially would just like, you know, scoff at that. And I was kind of like a little Republican, just trying to like defend America in a way to like defend my own ego, if that makes sense. And then by the time I had like, oh, go ahead.
They were attacking you.
They were attacking us.
the infidels.
Oh God. But the fact is that what was really happening in the environment I was growing up in, it was people were making statements in a non-dialectical context, and I was giving them non-dialectical answers, and I was going off of propaganda. I was going off of the ruling ideology, because again, I grew up. I mean, I was old enough to remember 9/11. Like, I couldn't process the events, but I was at least old enough to remember when, like, they'd show the clip of Osama making threats and I'd be scared of it type shit.
Oh,
so
yeah,
that was the environment. But so that is the American environment I grew up in. And yet, you know, living in Sterling Heights, like, I did grow up around like mostly Middle Eastern folks. You know what I mean? So I never was. It was a very bizarre circumstance where you grow up in this very, you know, rah-rah, go USA culture. But at the same time, I didn't have like those Islamophobic ideologies like put into me, but I didn't have a framework to explain it. Right. That was where I was. And then we moved back, I think after 6 years. So I did like middle and part of high school there, and I finished up high school here. And I think trying to understand why people disliked why the United States didn't have like the reputation abroad that it has at home, you know, I still was going in non-dialectical circles trying to explain that to myself. And I was a liberal for quite some time. I'm kind of in a bit of a baby leftist phase now. I still am reading theory. I'm still working on it, but I've embraced dialectical thinking. I've embraced rejecting mainstream ideology, and just, you know, not necessarily even like pushing the left agenda, but just, you know, trying to at least evangelize that there's a way to think about all this without making yourself crazy. So that to share my lived experience.
can you define dialectic?
Dialectical. So people will be mad with this, and I'm again. This is not the book definition, and this is also like me heavily paraphrasing. But what dialectics is, or it's also called historical materialism, is very simply looking at the historical and material circumstances of the events around you, and how they create the conditions in which you live. And there's a whole thing about, like, you know, the structure and superstructure and society, and that's another way to look at it. But very simply, it's just looking at what's in front of you. In fact, you know, there's if you really want to get woo about it, you could even say that like it's a kind of like philosophical mindfulness that you can apply to understanding where you are.
Okay, yeah.
If that makes sense.
The gist I got from your definition.
Right.
That's really interesting.
And then that's the thing. That's what ultimately informs a lot of socialist and left-wing thinking, is because we're not necessarily interested in the question of is America good or bad, or, you know, like those questions of angst that I had in my life, they were questions born of not thinking very, you know, in a mindful way or in a dialectic way. These were questions that were coming to me because I was trying to square away every circle without a good frame of reference or without the entire picture. So that's kind of, you know, my foray into diversity and identity politics, because, again, like we all went to the same school, but I worked in a campus department that dealt with diversity and stuff. And that was, again, another avenue I had before going deeper into learning about the left and absorbing some of those views. And I don't think that identity politics or social justice is standing in direct contradiction. It intersects, in my opinion, but I think...
I think the same.
Because, again, like... There's nothing standing, like there's no credible leftist who's going to tell you that, oh, don't worry about racism, it's all class. It's like, no, we will very clearly tell you that race and class intersect, or gender and class intersects, stuff like that. But I think because there is a hegemony, whether it's a corporate hegemony, whether it's the academic hegemony, the liberal hegemony, whatever you want to define it as, because they found a way to use this language and weaponize it, for example, if you bring up Kamala Harris's record as being overly carceral, you could get the accusation levied at you that, oh, you're attacking a woman of color, and that is both sexist and racist. And I'm like, that's not my motivation for the criticism, but that's how it gets deployed in effect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I want to love my brown sister, but like, she's making it really hard.
Well, and it's kind of crazy to think that, like, there's this idea that you can't say anything about a person of color or someone who's a part of a certain group, when, let's be honest, there's good and bad people everywhere. Like, 50% of the world, in my opinion, is probably questionable. I'll say not good and bad, because not for me to judge, but like, it just because you think something about someone doesn't mean you're attacking them because of their race. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But that's what it just devolves into at times, right?
Right, absolutely. It definitely does. Yeah.
And that's where it gets into things, right? Where we have what I see now, especially because, again, my main gripe is Twitter sucks. I guess if I have any consistent gripe, right? But I think it started with Tumblr, if anyone remembers those dark days. And it was just people, like, verbatim vomiting, like, academic sociological concepts for clout on Tumblr. And then they kind of just took it and ran with it onto Twitter when the porn was banned. That might have been it, but, like...
Tumblr porn was like a category.
Well, it was OnlyFans before OnlyFans was OnlyFans. Do you know what I mean?
It was LonelyFans, my friend.
Well, I tried starting a wildlife blog back in the day, and like no one fucking looked at it.
They didn't want to see
great tits and bush tits. They wanted to see.
I'm going to hell. They want to see doodoos.
Oh dear God. but that's where I'm getting into this, right? Is like, I think because of how inorganically I think that this discussion has propped up in society, right? It creates a strange divide for our people. By broadly, I'm speaking about brown people, South Asians, because, you know, are we people of color or are we
white adjacent?
We can talk about how, like, because of the Asian that section, a lot of people tend to be well employed and tend to have like means that, you know, doesn't exactly make them privy to the same experiences of other people of color, right? We have just a different cultural context, because you may have older South Asians who are a little more socially conservative, but then the younger ones who are a little more socially liberal. And then even the voting demographics, I think up until 9/11, like, it was 50-50 for brown people. Like, Muslim folks,
absolutely,
like, who voted consistently Republican and then had to migrate over to the Democratic Party, right? So there's this attempt to like plaster over something that I don't think is very mainstream in American society as like a reliable liberal constituency, when in reality, like, I don't think we've even begun to consider those questions for ourselves, you know?
like we don't even have, we haven't even begun to explore our political identity as a group. Is that what you're trying to say?
Partially, but I think also like, at least if I can describe my experience of being brown in America, right, is I don't have the same context as someone who grew up here the entire time. Like, Zarif, your context is a little different because you did live here the entire time. And I grew up here as a kid, then spent my adolescence there, and then came back as an adult. So partially, I think it is just childhood trauma. But I mean, I came back significantly older at that point. So, like, I had, like, that the fresh off the boat experience.
Yeah, you're 1.5 gen. You and Zarina.
Yeah,
are
1.5
gens. That's what I'm going to call you.
It's like you somehow didn't live in the country long enough, but you qualify, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You qualify because, for second gen.
It's quite not second gen, but it's, I mean, I can't call you like the auntie gen either or the uncle gen.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, shall I jump into my experience?
If you'd like to, yeah.
So I grew up in, I was, you know, brought up in Troy, Michigan, and I went through Troy schools all my life, you know, elementary, middle school, high school. Shout out Troy Union Elementary, Larson Middle, Troy Athens High.
Represent.
Represent. And a little fun story before I jump in. Adi, do you know what story I'm talking about?
Do you want to talk ethnic fair or do you want to talk...
Well, I guess I'll jump into that, I guess.
I mean, you can jump in with that. I think that's funny. I personally don't care if people have pictures of my ass, but...
Well, you know what? I'll lead into that, you know. Talk about
it. It's your story. You tell it.
Yeah. So, elementary school, you know, I didn't even really know what brown was until, like, someone pointed it out to me.
Mm.
You know, not in like the Hasan Minhaj, like, oh, you're the color of poop.
Wait, well, no, but like, not to interrupt, but like, I did not know what people meant by Indian for the longest time. So when people said Indian, like, I had to ask.
Yeah,
like,
I was confused.
I thought I was Native American, low key. Not to be on some Elizabeth Warren shit, but like, I had what, like,
Christopher Columbus shit, bro.
But like, again, like, I had people ask me, it's like, I said I was Indian, and they're like, oh, what tribe? And I'm like, what? So I went home, asked my mom, like, what's going on? And then, like, she said, like, yeah, no, it's India. It's this place. But continue.
Yeah. So, you know, I didn't really know until someone pointed it out to me. And, you know, every year, you know, around Christmas time, you know, we would do the Christmas extravaganza for all the parents, you know, they would come in and we would sing all these Christmas carols we learned in music class every December. Like, it was like the Friday before like Christmas break, you know, so everyone was hyped, like, yeah, fuck yeah, like all the kids are about to get presents and stuff. Not this kid though, but
so you had Christmas trauma too.
No, I it wasn't trauma because like I still got to watch like Home Alone, shout out to Kevin McAllister, you know, Home Alone 2 always makes me cry. But anyways, you know, that's like really, you know, when I started to feel like, okay, like, you know, I am not like my lived experience, if you will, is not the same as what I'm seeing like through media, you know, at that point, because, you know, in the 2000s, a lot of our culture was through the lens of, you know, like TV and like the internet was just starting up too, you know? So a lot of my perceptions of like what an American is came from TV, and clearly I wasn't that. And I think I started to internalize that probably as early as like 6 or 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you guys, but and that's weird. I kind of feel bad about saying that because, you know, when people think Troy, they're like, oh, it's this like diverse city, but like I'm gonna keep it 100, like there's this really kind of weird dynamic in Troy where I feel like there's this faction that like wants Troy to be, you know, it's not like a forceful like separation, but like there's behaviors that they partake in and language that they partake in, or,
well,
you know, the friends circles that they partake in that, like, exclude, like, my, like, not just brown people, but other people of color as well, in Troy. And I kind of found that dynamic to be, you know, interesting when people brought up the diversity as well.
Right, right. And I think what I find a little interesting about Troy as a community, right, is it's very solidly upper middle class in its composition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is a nice little suburb created from, like, the white flight of Detroit. It's I mean, that's literally what it is.
Yep, absolutely.
It's like, again, all these nice little houses that were redlined, and then now you had Asian people and now other groups now coming in. But to me, what it always seemed like is this is the kind of class system we have in America, where are you a consumer who can afford an apartment, or are you a consumer who can afford a McMansion? And mm-hmm. Troy has McMansion consumers, but then there's Mega McMansion consumers. And it's just as much of a wealth thing as it is a race thing, in my opinion, because you don't want people making the neighborhood weird. I mean, it's one of those things. You can reduce it down to these kind of stupid.
You know, I know exactly what you mean, Aditya.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's yeah, a very exactly stupid. It's a very stupid instinct, and, like, I can't cite it academically, right?
And the thing is, but I think it stems from, like, the fact that, like, you know, we've always, like, I think, you know, as Asian Americans as a whole, like, we've always felt, you know, perpetual foreignness.
Well, yeah, and that's why, like, you know, a lot of people will bring up that, oh, Asians always self-segregate, but it's like, to an extent, that's 100% true, but I think it's just the fact of, like, well, if we all live in this pocket, they don't have to worry about us. It's like this whole, like, let me go out of my way to make sure you don't see me type business.
And so that's kind of why, like, when I have this gripe when, you know, when other minority groups and white people both, like, tell, like, Asian Americans that they're, you know, white adjacent, where, you know, I get it, like, a lot of, you know, our people, you know, due to the, you know, Immigration Act of 1965, you know, favoring, you know, certain, you know, groups of people, you know, to immigrate over here, you know, that those social implications are, you know, they help to build what the Asian American identity is in America today.
Right.
And I get, but at the same time, it's like they call us white adjacent, but, you know, that's all it is it's adjacent. It's not like we move in, you know, I guess, you know, proximity to white people, but it's not like they accept us into their circles readily. You know what I mean?
It almost feels like a dumb way
for that conversation.
But it feels like a dumb way to describe class. You know what I mean? Like, you're just saying you're in the same tax bracket as them. But
I am, yeah. Well, absolutely.
Let's revisit this point, because you did want to finish your lived experience. We'll revisit this in a sec.
Yeah. Well, I was just gonna say, you know, Troy, this is, like, also where I started to learn the dynamic of, you know, social, like, you know, who's on top and who's it easier for. You know, it might kind of sound weird that, like, wow, like, how does an 8-9-year-old understand this? But, like, the thing is, I didn't, like, back then, I didn't understand that I understood it until – I didn't understand that I understood it till I got older, if that makes sense. Because it's, like, stuff you internalize and, like, you push to the surface, because it's, like, okay, you know what? I don't want to even talk about this. I just want to fit in as much as possible. Like, I want to just be, like, a Disney Channel white boy.
You wanted to be Chad. You didn't want to be
– yeah.
Like, you wanted to be, like, Zach. You didn't want to be Zarif.
Yeah, and I actually do have a story. Like, I'll get into that in the middle school chapter.
Dear God.
The middle school.
But, like, this is, like, I actually had a PTA, a parent teacher association, mom, like, comment, like, on my amazing English.
Oh my Yikes. God. Can I say, quick interjection? Sorry, Zarif.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is so. I mean, people say that, and even, like, growing up in Bangladesh, I mean, the South Asian countries now, like, English medium schools, which are, like, English as the primary language, is so common. So all of my friends, even back home, who never left the country other than vacationing, they can all speak really good English and have not that much of an accent. So it's so wild to me. Plus, you were born and raised here. Like, don't get me wrong, but it's just an interesting concept to me that I just, it boggles my mind when people are like, oh, well, you speak really good English. And it's like, yeah. Anyway,
it,
go
it,
ahead.
It could, that kind of ties into the perpetual foreignness, you know.
And yeah.
I didn't know how to, you know, I didn't have the rhetoric or, you know, to phrase what I was feeling, but that's exactly what I was feeling. You know, I can pinpoint it to that.
Well, I mean, that is what in sociology, I guess they refer to as the other, right? Is mm-hmm. that's your first mm-hmm. time you realize that you are the other.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I will say this one thing, positive thing about Troy is that I was brought up in a very, you know, tight-knit Bangladeshi community. You know, we've been here ever since the 80s. My dad was actually one of the first Bangladeshis in Troy. Shout out for those Ghazi. you know, so I did have that community to fall back on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad for, you know, a lot of those Desi kids that, like, grow up in those, like, lily white, you know, suburbs. And they have no community, really, to fall back on. I can't even imagine that, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is probably a good place for me to follow back up on that, right?
Yeah, right.
Because, first of all, the whole white adjacent thing, I think that comes from people who are familiar. And it's one of those things that is rooted in a bit of a complex history. Like, I remember reading somewhere that when there was a push to define Indian Americans or like people of brown descent, they lobbied to be classified as white.
Because that's where they saw the power.
That's where, yeah. So, like, the white adjacent thing, like, it's not to say that, like, the, you know, the oppression is uniformly applied. Sometimes it's strategically considered. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's, yeah. I mean, so that's where, like.
What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I just mean that, like, sometimes when people feel like they have they can negotiate how much oppression they're willing to take. I mean, like in the Matrix, right? Where they're like, we have a certain level of survival we're willing to accept.
Right.
Sometimes that is how, like, people try to bargain with discriminatory forces in the past. So that's where, like, white adjacent comes from. But I think the real problem, I think, is that people will use an academic term that's and then not properly define it and then use it as a cudgel to beat someone over in a discussion that's not happening in good faith. So I get your, you know, your opposition to the term, because
yeah, I feel like it was, you know,
because I still don't know what that person meant by that.
Yeah, you know, I feel like it was being used in, like, kind of a, I don't know, like, I it's hard to tell by tone.
Right. Right. Well, so, but yeah, so to your point about how, like, there might be, you know, other brown kids growing up in other suburbs, right? I think we really don't understand the distribution and the different waves of immigration that have happened for Indian people in the United States, or Indian adjacent people, like folks from Pakistan, folks from Sri Lanka, folks from Bangladesh.
Desis.
Desis, yeah. I still don't have a term in my head, right? But yeah, like, I think a lot of people came over in the 80s or, like, during the tech boom in the Clinton era, but then there were later waves that came. There were ones that happened prior, and I think those folks did face a lot of violence. And that's where we, you know, run into the Bobby Jindal types, right? Or Nikki Haley types, right? Who we, you know, our generation will accuse them of, like, willingly whitewashing themselves. And I, to be honest, that is the criticism I have of them as well. But this was also a generation where a lot of, if you faced violence, you probably just did whatever you could to, like, say, hey, I assimilated, don't hurt me. You know what I mean? So that could define the experiences of that generation. There's also a lot of brown people who live in rural areas that we just don't interact with, because in America, urban, suburban, and rural people don't interact. We're very segregated by geography at times. So we don't talk about brown people who live in rural communities and might, you know, run the gas station or some kind of small business. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, so the community itself is not a unified diaspora.
No, no, it's not. And even to that point, I'm going to drop in some, I don't think a lot of people know about this, but there has been, like, a lot of, like, hate crimes against Asian elders in, like, the past few weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just seeing this, but I haven't done my reading. Do you know what's, like, the background
is?
I've actually done a lot of
research on this the past few days. But pretty much, ever since COVID, you know, there has been, like, a huge increase on, like, anti-Asian hate crimes. I think, like, there was, like, 2,000 reported between, like, March and September alone, and that's just reported.
And this is
about, and Asian people, you know, and we're not, you know, a lot of us don't like to, you know, speak out about, you know, especially, you know, the immigrant generation.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm, right. I can imagine this was mostly a lot of it was happening to, you know, the people that were not only visibly, but, you know, you could also tell that.
It was mostly elders it was happening to, right? This most recent wave, at least, right?
Yeah. And I think it stems from two things. One thing being, you know, I think people perceive Americans in American society in general portrays Asians as, like, you know, subservient, meek, you know, the model minority, whatever. You know, that's part of, like, the negative. You know, it's negative ways it can play into, you know, the submissiveness, you know.
I think what you're mentioning, that's kind of why I stray away from the white adjacent thing, is because though we get certain privileges over other minority groups, there's also things where we can relate, you know, where we're still, there's microaggressions and we're still minoritized. So it's definitely a very nuanced kind of intersectionality, and all those things play into race and how we define it.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, that's a more accurate approach than I think how sometimes brown people are kind of, like, cynically shuffled around in the I guess what people call oppression Olympics, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's, I mean, yeah, completely agree.
And it's crazy because I feel like it's not getting, this should be getting a lot more attention. Like, I've been seeing, like, 2-3 incidences every day the past, like, 2-3 weeks. And I've only been seeing it because I follow Asian accounts on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's literally the only reason why I know. Especially in urban communities in California,
right?
I think there is a lot of tension between there's a lot of historical tensions between the Black and Asian communities. I don't know if you guys are aware, but
well, I mean, you had
the LA riots, in 1992. You know, where the second day of the rioting, 60% of Koreatown, I think, was, like, destroyed pretty much. Like, billions and billions of, like, billions of dollars of damage, you know. Just crazy. And the thing people don't know is that the police didn't help the Black people, nor did they help the Koreans.
Mm. So it's kind of like an op when every time this shit happens, right? Where it's like, hey, the rioters did it, not us.
And then I hated the whole, like, you know, have you heard about the roof Koreans? Like, that they, do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
oh, okay, so the roof Koreans is, like, this famous picture that the American media put out to the public, where it had these two, like, Korean store owners on the top of, like, their storefront, like, pointing guns down at rioters and saying, like, oh, like, look at these people, like, you know, protecting their... you know, like, they're fighting off the rioters, like, yeah, like, screw those Black people, you know.
And it just keeps getting deployed, like, every time there is a BLM protest that had a riot, or, you know, was reported as a riot, the store owner who needs to defend his property always gets brought up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the first time they probably deployed that, or, you know, at least a well-known time of when it was deployed.
The thing is, my issue with the roof Korean picture was how the white American media tried to spin it as like Asians being against.
Well, hang on. This isn't exactly. I don't want to offend all of our viewers.
No, hold up. Hold up. And I know what you're about to say, Adi. But like, this is a very like a nuanced. Like,
okay.
Thing. They weren't actually shooting down at the rioters. They were shooting down at the ground to like prevent rioters from going into their area. But the media didn't report that.
Mm.
You know, they were just like willingly saying like, oh, like look at these, you know, they're pointing guns at them and stuff. Like they're not getting the whole picture.
Right.
And boy, doesn't that sound familiar?
It does. And I think like, you know, when we talk about violence in this country, I think the push of like, well, it's got to be law and order. Like it seems like a way to just smooth over the entire tension that exists in society and how it manifests in far more complex ways. Some of which are contradictory all the time. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just one of those things that I think it gets brought up where the Asian community is one that has a level of property that gives it a bit of an economic standing,
mm-hmm.
but it shouldn't be something that gets, how do I put this? Just because like Asian people were able to take advantage of financial things like loans and those financial services that Black people didn't have access to,
mm-hmm.
we shouldn't also like buy the propaganda that it's because we worked harder. No, that's where thinking dialectically comes back into this, right? It's like, no, the reality is we had discriminatory policies and materially mm-hmm. they had financial results where Asians had the means to start businesses or buy property in ways that Black people just didn't in America, right? And that's ultimately like when we talk about the divide, it's not just one of just pure behavior or pure racism. It's also just one of like quite literally who was able to make money and who wasn't.
Right. It's systematic. I mean,
yep.
Classism plays such a big role in the States, and where it's, I feel like a lot of the negative things I hear about, for example, Black communities, it's so untrue. And the way I address it with people is, when you are at a level where you're not usually, but a lot of Black communities are poor communities. And then on top of that, the whole system is against you in a lot of different ways. And we've improved slowly, but in the sense of like, we're getting to some basic rights, like redlining's now not allowed, even though the effects of that and the repercussions of that is still super, super apparent. There are these systematic issues that keeps people oppressed and keeps them from being able to get from one class to another. And I think it's so interesting that I feel like a lot of the conception of, you know, poorer or like underprivileged communities, they will go against other underprivileged communities rather than pointing our concerns at those who are, you know, at the top and not reaching down to help. You know what I mean?
That's actually what's kind of happening with these elderly Asian attacks is, you know, you've got working class Asian communities and working class Black communities fighting for limited resources. Mm-hmm. I think that's like the larger picture that I'm seeing.
Well, do they know who's been committing the violence, or is that just what we've been told?
No, they know. They know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, media, media is a whole nother thing where I like, especially with social media, which I know, Zarif, you are very, like, I'm sure you read multiple sources,
absolutely.
Which is great.
Yeah, before I, yeah.
Yeah, like, you're not the kind of person who's like, oh, I read this on this one site I've never heard of.
Yeah, because like you, I've only seen this stuff on Instagram, and it's like,
it's hard to vet, yeah.
I've done my own education about this stuff.
Okay.
Because, you know, California itself as a state, I think, you know, if you study the history of that state, it will really give you a good.
Right. And it gets dismissed as this kind of liberal bastion when quite literally it isn't.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, there is so many, you know, there's like a lot of Latino history there. There's a lot of Asian history there. There's a lot of Black history there. you know, it's what makes America like like when people think diversity, you know, they think of like, oh, California, New York.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very inflated sense of importance that both those states get, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know. But, like, you know, you get the gist of, like, yeah, they're diverse states.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to follow that up, and I don't know how.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out a way to wrap up a bow on all this, because, I mean, we're about to approach the top of the hour, but I like where this is going. I will have to do some editing, though.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I might have had, like, my USB. I use, like, a really shitty USB hub to keep, like, all my shit plugged in. I don't have a PC. I just have, like, two laptops.
Yeah.
And the hub just decides when it wants to be plugged in and when it's not. So you hear that little Windows all the time. And if it's in the podcast audio, I apologize. I really do. I will one day learn how to run an audio app, but today is not that day.
Technology box. Like, my laptop just turned off in the middle. It was just like, a bye, and it's plugged in.
I saw that. Okay. I think my webcam unplugged itself. I don't understand, man.
Yeah, you know, I actually, like, disconnected from you guys for, like...
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that. Ugh. Well, you think with a call with three brown people on it, we'd be able to run some tech support. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. We got the tech, but not the support. I'll tell you that.
I'll tell you. Ooh-wee.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. This was fun. I think we had, like, a good discussion. Maybe we can definitely pick up on, I think, the kind of sectarian shit that our community deals with, like the Hindu and Muslim shit.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
We could get into, like, a premium episode on moldy and shit if we wanted to.
Oh, man.
But I will save that for another day.
And maybe we could go into, like, what's happening with the protests too, the farmers.
We could get into that for sure. We just didn't have the time today.
Yeah, but I do think that's very important.
It is.
Right now. Especially for diaspora.
Yep,
As well, we should be really, you know, paying attention to that.
It is. And I think that, you know, even if you're not part of the diaspora, I think if you're looking for how people are fighting neoliberalism abroad, I think it is a useful, even if it is somewhat imperfect, example of how people are taking action on it. So with that, is there anything you guys want to end on or anything you want to plug?
Thank you for having us. This is so fun. I am a fan of greenhouse gaslighting. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, Adi, thank you so much for having us. Yeah, greenhouse gaslighting, everyone.
You know. We'll plug the podcast we're on. That's what
oh, my God. Well, how about I give the plug right now? You can follow us at Greenhouse Gaslighting on Facebook or at Pod Greenhouse on Twitter. I'm going to put the email in the chat. Or not the chat, no, the description. I'm sorry, guys. It's been a day. And yeah, we're on a bunch of platforms, but I think most people use Spotify or Stitcher. We're there. And yeah, send us an email. Send us a review. Tell us good things. Try not to tell us bad things, but I'll read them.
Adi's open to all feedback.
I'm open to all feedback right now. I'll see something that has like 20 views and I'm like, yes.
Well, Adi, I'll feed you some back.
Oh, goodness.
Sure. Yeah. Bye.